Welcome to the Sons of Liberty podcast, coming to you from the Liberty Tree Studio in San Antonio, Texas, where we discuss topics of the day, firearms, great food, and even better whiskey. Grab a drink, sit down with your host, the founding daddies, Mike Mahalski and Kyle Grothus.
All right, guys, we're here with Chris Alvarez and Matt McGuire from Green Ops Training. Is that the proper name for the company?
Yeah.
So Matt used to work for us back in the day, was a customer service guy for us before he got into the training world. And Chris, tell us a little bit about your background.
So my background is an Army guy. Spent 20 years in the Army, Special Forces, Ranger, Infantry. My whole entire career was spent in combat arms. Retired in 2016 as a first sergeant / my sergeant. And then shortly after that, Mike picked me up to be one of the instructors for Green Ops and become the training director for the Green Ops chapter up in Northern Virginia. And I've been doing that since 2018. It's 2023, so it's been a hot minute, man, and we've been doing really good.
And Green Ops was originally only in Virginia, right? I guess when Mike was stationed up there?
Yeah, that's correct. So when Mike PCS to San Antonio, he's like, hey, man, do you want to take over Green Ops? And I'm like, sure, I'll take over Green Ops. And it's right before COVID era. So we were initially getting about 10, 12 students per class. And then next thing you know, it grew up to 15. Next thing you know, Pascal, Mike's wife, was like, hey, Chris, I got a couple guys on standby. Do you mind putting them in? I was like, yeah, no worries. And next thing you know, we're having 20, 23 students per class. Not that being that consistent lately, but yeah, that's how Green Ops really grew. We only started out with 3 instructors in Northern Virginia. We currently have 11 instructors, so that's how busy we are.
That's awesome. I think the Green Ops is the one. I think I've taken the most classes from y'all. Anybody else? I think it's like 3 or 4 now that I've done. So,
and to give a little bit of context to this, you know, if you haven't heard of Mike Green or Green Ops, I highly suggest you look into them. I thought it was very cool. Whenever we publicly announced a partnership between Sons of Liberty and Green Ops, the amount of phone calls I got from friends of mine around the industry that were true professionals, you know, guys that, you know, GRS or guys that were in special operations or guys, whatever, calling me saying, hey, man, great job, you know, because his reputation in that community was so, so strong. And that, like, that to me is a really it builds a lot of confidence when you're getting so many calls from so many respected professionals saying, hey, good job on that deal, you know?
Yeah, Matt, you want to tell us about yourself? I remember when you were working for us, we went out to go shoot pistols one time, and you're giving me some pointers and stuff, and I was like, man, you should think about doing this instructor thing full time. Pretty good.
Yeah, so it started for me shooting, obviously, like the whole thing, shooting when you're young and learning to shoot as a kid, and then it turned into sort of a passion for me, really coming into the Marine Corps in the early mid 2000s, coming out of that and going to shoot competition. You come out of the military going, yeah, I know how to shoot. I know what to do. I've got this. And then you go shoot against guys who are real professionals. They're M's, GM's, high level shooters in whatever discipline. And you find out real quick that you don't know what you don't know. And that lit a fire for me to chase that. And I think I'm, I don't know, a couple thousand hours of professional training from the highest guys in the industry, Bill Blowers, Chuck Pressburg, Steve Fisher, Scott Jedlinski, who's my mentor and endorses me as a red dot pistol instructor. And then with Mike, it turned into, hey, you put this work in, do you want to come teach with me? And that was a huge change for me and a shift. And I realized what I was passionate about. And it's really about seeing the lights come on for students. And that became the path I chose forward. And it's been now a little over three years I've been teaching with Mike.
Yeah. I was bummed whenever you left Sons of Liberty because I mean it takes a certain level of like understanding of the product and then the ability to communicate that in a way that was, you know, digestible for people. And every time I would hear you talking to a potential client about the product, you had a really good way of explaining it in a way that was digestible. And so if you took that to the Green Ops, man, then that's just awesome. I've heard you in action for the Sun side, and you're very, very good at that.
Well, that's honestly the biggest thing for me when I left to go work with Mike. I was immediately turn around and be like, Mike, you need to go talk to the guys at Suns. You need to get involved with them. We need to get a relationship going and support that, because honestly, the industry eats each other on the daily basis. Like, people are so willing, whether it's the training side, whether it's manufacturing, production side, whether whatever it is, there's so many people out there that want to turn on each other for whatever reason. And to me, it makes more sense to support the people that support you and support the industry as a whole. And for me, coming back to Suns was just natural. It came back to this because I know the product. I know the people that are doing it. I know the guys that are at the helm here. And the ship's pointed the right direction. It's about the community. It's about giving quality equipment, quality training. And combining those things seemed like a no-brainer for me. So.
Yeah, and staying out of a lot of the industry drama.
Oh, yeah.
There's a reason why we've really never anchored to anything, and that's because it really is. It's unfortunately a cannibalistic and volatile environment sometimes, and I see stuff that is unproductive. You know, I mean, this is a small community. This is a kind of I look at it as an us versus them, like us being the guys that are in this space against Google and mm-hmm. Bank of America and, oh, yeah. You know.
That's a losing battle, right?
Facebook, right? So, I mean, like, I wish there was a little bit more solidarity amongst, you know, even the industry side for, like, retail or for manufacturers. I wish there was a little bit more solidarity even amongst the instruction side. But either way, guys, it has been a real pleasure for the last 3 years to work with Green. Actually, it's been like 4 years mm-hmm. to work with Green Ops. You guys, I think, do an amazing job of instruction, promoting the brand, and then bringing the equipment and the training side together. And then, you know, okay, you have this awesome piece of equipment, and now let's see how far and hard you can push it through the training. And then that's, you know, that's really what elevates and does what we want to do, which is, like, make better, more proficient shooters.
That came to proof this last weekend. We taught LPVO out there, and there were people out there with every denomination of, you know, ADM or whatever, every other gun out there, just, you know, 15 guys on the line with different guns. And everybody that was running a Suns was, it was like, I didn't have to lube it. I didn't have to mess with it. I didn't have to fix it. And we had several students who were, like, at wit's end with their equipment, because they could not get it to run right. They couldn't make it. And it destroys your ability to learn because you're so worried about your equipment. And to hand somebody something like, hey, this is something you never have to worry about again. Put lube on it, put ammo in it, and shoot the gun. Like, that's it. And that, for me, was a huge... I mean, obviously, I've seen it happen so many times now, it's kind of commonplace. But to see people be like, oh, your gun doesn't ever go down? No. I don't even clean the thing. I think I have 7,000 rounds with a couple of the guns that... I've probably sprayed lube on them 5-6 times before classes, but they just keep going. They just keep going and going and going, and it's never been an issue. So,
yeah, and I was talking to Carlos yesterday, and maybe potentially because of that same issue right there, we would like to see if we can get some loaner Sons of Liberty guns in the LPVO class. And this is where I'm going at, right? Not because to expose the students that are coming into the class that, hey, your gun's broken, but there's a better product out there, a reliable product that we endorse, that we use, and then kind of bringing them into the Sons of Liberty space.
Yeah, we can definitely get some of the new broadswords with the Precision Series barrels out there. I know you just switched yours, Matt.
Oh, yeah.
You've been running like champs. Did Carlos come down? Was he down shooting, teaching this class too? Or
No. So Carlos came over there yesterday morning for shooting video, taking a couple of pictures and here and there. And there were several Suns guns in there, but we had a couple of students that had a lot of issues with their guns in there. And like, I had the culminating exercise, the live fire portion, I had to stop it, like, because the guy had so many malfunctions, like stop.
What was the other guy that was there when I took the class last year? The shorter army guy.
Jose Gordy Gordon. So what's up, Jose? I call him Uncle Gordy. So
Jose
Uncle,
was awesome. Yeah,
Uncle Gordy. He's modest until you get him talking. But Uncle Gordy jumped into Grenada, jumped into Panama. So he's been on the cusp of every war since 1983. And then we also have another instructor. His name is Max Dello, a little Filipino guy. And both Max and Jose were roommates in 1st Ranger Battalion, and they both jumped into Panama together. So actually, there's a book out there. I think it's called Cry Havoc that just came out, and it's got all those dudes and all their stories in there from, you know, jumping.
Pick that up.
Yeah. And the other cool part about Jose is that because Jose's been on the cusp of every single American war, the war, anything that we've been involved in since 1983, he was there during the inception of the LPVO. So he was there on the drawing board, so he can speak very intelligently to how the requirements came about to come out with the LPVO.
It's always nice when you have guys that were actually present when it happened, you know?
It's nice to see a lot of the work we do at different agencies and stuff. There was a reluctance for a long time to allow LPVO in certain police agencies.
Yeah, Texas couldn't. They were limited to, what, 3-power about 5-6 years ago?
Well, so TTP, I mean, not TTP, I'm sorry, TCOL had some restrictions, and then, like, you know, local jurisdictions. The LPVO wasn't even approved for, like, SAPD until the last, like, maybe 2 years.
Yeah, you had to go to sniper school.
You had to go to sniper school. And I think what the concern was that there was, like, the optics, not the mechanical equipment version of the optics. I'm saying, like, the overall optics of, like, the militarization of something, whatever. And to me, it sounds weird to deprive somebody of the right tool for the job. Like, I mean, my general purpose rifles have LPVOs. Like, most of my rifles, you know, have an LPVO because it really is the most versatile, I think, thing you can do. You can turn that thing down to 1. It's quite fast for its acquisition, and then dial it up to 10, and now you can really identify stuff. You can, you know, just put better fire on target. So that's a great option. The fact that it's only been, like, in the last 2 or 3 years that you've seen, I think, that thing adopted in certain institutions.
Right.
Is bizarre.
I mean, if you look at the Tennessee active shooter situation that happened, I think, this year, you can hear law enforcement saying, hey, bring that LPVO up front, bring that LPVO. And the main thing that, you know, brand new shooters think when mounting an LPVO is they're going to put bipolygs on there and then create some sort of sniper system. But the reality is, in the classes, we talk about those intermediate shots, like maybe 30, 40, 50 yards, something like maybe a suspect holding a baby as a hostage and being able to have the capability to dial up, to magnify and see really what you need to aim at, like a crisp, fine aiming point, and taking those high critical shots is extremely important. So lately we started seeing a lot of law enforcement officers having a capability with having an LPVO. Just yesterday or this weekend, we had a Houston PD cop show up to our class that, you know, that he's implement. He's getting training on the LPVO, and hopefully that training that he got this weekend will go ahead and propagate that when he goes back to his agency and train his guys and really understand what the capabilities and limitations of the LPVO are.
Right, or to be able to see it. Is that a cell phone? Is that a gun? You know,
like, yeah,
you know, like, I mean, absolutely. Like, you know, like, be able to, you know, to make sure that, you know, you have accurate, you know, information to be able. But no, I mean, that. Which LPVOs do you normally suggest? What do you personally like?
I like Vortex. I've been running the Vortex. They've never failed me. I started out with the Vortex 106 a couple of years back. I think that anything above 6-power, just again, my opinion, it's overkill on a 5.56 platform. Because then the you start going to 1-10s, the verticals get really busy with the MRADs and all that stuff. I'm very keep it simple, stupid kind of guy. So I want just nice, clean reticle in there, maybe a red dot in there, and being able to see what I need to see and then engage it. But yeah, I've been running the Vortex 106. They got a really good warranty, so I've kind of broken them maybe once or twice, just tying up to the screws on the mount, and then the red dot not being able to turn down, so shipped that over, came back about a week later, maybe 2 weeks. And I also have a Viper PST that's on a Grey Ghost precision gun. And that thing.
Boo.
Boo. Boo.
Sorry.
But that Viper PST, it's only like maybe, I think, $500 versus the Vortex. And I'll tell you what, I run that thing like nobody's business.
Well, that's the thing to realize. Like, people forget, they take for granted, we're kind of living in the golden age of equipment and optics and stuff. We're coming off 20 years of development of equipment, and we're seeing cheaper, better quality, higher capability equipment that does the thing you need it to do, and you don't have to go buy a $4,000 optic or whatever. I mean, And the other part of that, so shout out Chuck Pressburg. I think he said it the best when you're talking about LPVOs. It's not about shooting far. It's about seeing.
Yes.
Right? And if you got a guy peeking through a taillight as a law enforcement officer and you need to be able to see what he's doing, what's going on, like that information gathering is the capability that's afforded you. You just don't have with a red dot. Even with a magnifier and a red dot, you lose so much field of view. And it takes a lot more, and it weighs the same as LPVO. I think that's kind of the balance point. The other thing being vision, physical limitations. Like, if you have bad astigmatism, red dots probably aren't going to be as crisp, especially when you throw a magnifier on it. So there's questions that people have, and we hear it all the time. People come to the classes, and they're like, oh, well, what do you recommend for this? I'm like, man, what do you do? Where do you live?
Right.
What is it your role, right? Or if it's a truck gun, and this is going to hurt feelings, guys, you're not going to run out of an active shooting situation to your car, grab a rifle, and then run back in. If you do, it's probably not a great plan, right? So that equipment set that you're choosing needs to be based on your realistic expectation of what your role is. And when you start throwing those things down for people, they're like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. I'm like, why didn't I think of that? I'm like, I don't know, because you haven't thought about it. You haven't actually thought about it. And then when you look at the rifles and all we talked about malfunctions and all the things that you see in training – to come back to this, it's always, I kind of took it for granted, I guess, coming up into this culture where you have a gun that you're like, hey, something broke. Like, well, that's weird. Mm-hmm. How many rounds are we in? I don't know, 60,000, you know, have a suppressor fly off or something like that. You're like, all right, cool. Good. Time to re-up now. But it's super interesting for me to see the industry change and see the development of new optics, new technology, and being able to go out there and buy something off the shelf readily available that does those things, whether it's a Razor, whether it's a Trigicon Credo or whatever it is, and have those discernments and go out and apply it. And that was really put on display this weekend. We saw all the equipment, the guys come out. So
that's why I encourage so many of our customers to go out and actually take a class. Like, not, you know, you can go out to the range, you can shoot some targets, but unless you're shooting against a clock, or you're shooting drills, or there's some type of metric to gauge, you know, whether or not you're getting any better. I think it's very difficult to, it's hard to just go out there and shoot on your own without any type of metric to see if you're making any kind of progress. And some of these better, more demanding carbine classes, you know, they have the round counts where you can start to see what your equipment is made of. One of the things that I always blew me away was when I would go to one of these classes and dudes and students show up with, you know, this rifle that's completely tricked out. And by the end of the day, how much stuff was laying on the, on the ground, like how much stuff was taken off the gun.
Yeah.
You know, just from sitting there and, you know, running a fairly basic course. Right. But sometimes the stuff wasn't just taken off for the sake of weight, because I mean, if there's an item or an accessory on the weapon that's critical to like do what you have to do, you're going to have to put up with some of the weight. Like, how much stuff would just rattle loose or just fall off the gun, right?
Because old tactical yard sale.
Yeah. Well, and you know, or magazines, you know, like some of the magazines that, you know, look really good on Instagram. And then, you know, there are instructors out there, very reputable, good instructors, that will make you, at this onset of class, if you have a particular magazine, take it out and put it, you know, throw it back in your truck. Because, I mean, you know, they're just tired of having them.
We had that this weekend. Lancer's mags were shit. Hex mags were,
like, hex mags are the ones that I was in. Yeah, hex mags. Sorry, Hex, but yeah. it happens.
It's a reality. I mean, yeah. we're seeing it in real time.
So, yeah, we had a student came out with Lancer mags. He's like, man, they're great. I've had no issues with them. I was like, let me see your mag. Grabbed it, and I just started bashing the bottom, and it just dumped like half his mag on the ground. And I didn't even hit it hard. It was just like, bam, and it shot half his magazine out on the ground. And he looked at me, he's like, you gonna pick all that up? I was like, absolutely not. That's your mag. Like, get to it, bud. But yeah, it is. It's, people don't know. And when you, like you said, Mike, when you go to a class, you're going to find out. You're going to prove positive. If it's a quality class and you got dudes testing your equipment, pushing you to the limit and trying to find out what is and what isn't good, you're going to know.
I remember, this, Kyle, we hosted Jeff Gonzalez one time. Mm-hmm. This was very, very early on in Sons Liberty. I mean, we were probably two, maybe 3 years
ago. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a long time ago. Jeff's a good guy. I like him a lot. But we hosted a class for him, and his class was basically the basically just an SQT qualification. It was like the SQT qual.
Yeah, SEAL qualification.
Right, but I mean, you know, it's like a it's like 50 meters and in, and basically, but every shot you fire from 50 meters and in, and we're not talking about movement. There's it is static. The target's static. Mm-hmm. You're static. It's mostly focused like on press and
accuracy,
you know, like reset and like just all of the fundamentals. And I don't think a single student in that class actually received a passing score. Everybody left a better shooter. Everybody, I think, improved as a shooter, but nobody actually received a passing score. And his philosophy was, well, you know, why are you going to start running and doing complex movement or, you know, what other kinds of barricades and all kinds of other stuff, you know, if like the very most basic fundamentals, you know, are not mastered yet, you know, and like, and so I thought that was an interesting approach to it. I was a little bit surprised because, you know, shooting a, you know, I don't know, basically a 3-inch.
Yeah, we're shooting 4-inch circles. Yeah, he had a real tiny, yards. Small little tie. Yeah, at when we got to 50, I think he moved it to an 8-inch.
Still, but, I mean, you, Matt can definitely do that, right? Because Matt's a wizard with the red dot.
It was definitely aim small, miss small. I think out to 25, 30 yards, we're still shooting a 4-inch circle. So it was tough class.
But I got a counter to that. So during our courses at the LPBO class, we run a culminating exercise. So we teach guys how to shoot, move, and communicate, how to maximize the capabilities of the LPBO. So they're running two-man teams. And so that really, it like guys, their eyes open because you got a lot of courses and you do a lot of flat range drills. But how do you apply that into an actual practical application, right? And now you guys got, like the students, you see them, they got to think, they got to communicate, they got to do all these subtasks, attack reloads, target transition, getting out of the scope because they get sucked into the scope. So the experience or that I provide for them is to open their eyes like, holy crap, I really need to dial this in. Like, I need to figure this thing out because a lot of them think that they're good until they do the culminating exercise or we put them through advanced drills or just not even advanced drills. I wouldn't call them advanced drills. They're just basic fundamentals at a higher level. And so they kind of like, holy crap, there's a lot more than just static shooting and being on the range. And like now there's practicality involved. I have to communicate. And so my end state for my class is to give those guys an experience so they can act in some sort of skill set. Now they're not going to become operators by the end of it. They finish my course, but at least they have a basic understanding of fire maneuver and something that they can actually hold on to and maybe talk through to maybe a neighbor or something like that in case something happens. And then they're able to organize and plan and execute a plan to defeat that problem set.
Well, and that's talking with Chris about it, like automating the gun. Most people don't ever do that. They don't train to that level because it's hard. It's really easy to give people diagnostics and you chop low-hanging fruit like, hey, your draw is messed up because you're doing this, or your presentations with the rifle is messed up because you're taking all this time, you're moving your head, you're changing everything. You cut that low-hanging fruit and they're like, man, I am doing great. And then you throw like, hey, we're just going to move to two or three different positions and you're going to shoot at targets. You've never seen a grown man melt. Mm-hmm. In the middle of an exercise, just like staring at his gun and the mag's out, and he's looking at his equipment. And he's like, and then his partner goes, moving, and he's like, shit. And then he just has a meltdown. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, guys, you're literally walking or shooting and moving. Like, just point the gun and move up to the next position, and then yell out, hey, I'm here. Right. And when you can automate the gun part, and this, we really harped on this weekend. When you can automate the gun, all that other stuff opens the bandwidth so you can process.
Absolutely.
And if you can't do that, don't think you're some capable citizen individual until you automate the process. The gun part needs to be reflexive and reactive. You have a good foundation, you got great grip, you got good position. Well, all those things that you build, that's the mechanical part that supports tactics. So many people want to be like, I'm going to go take a CQB class. I'm like, bro, you pointed your gun at three people in the last 45 minutes. Like. Yeah. You don't need to be in a building with five other people in the dark. You need to sit down and work that. And there's a point. There's an argument you made. Like, fundamentals are the way we shoot. That is the mechanical act of pointing a gun at the target and pulling the trigger without disturbing the sights. But when you go to the next thing, if those mechanical skills aren't built, you can't do those other things. And the same thing in classes. When you're watching guys melt on the line, they don't have the prerequisite skill to go past that. They haven't gotten outside of looking at the gun and worrying about the magazine and worrying about their safety and worrying about their belt. Those things have to be reflexive and reactive. And if you're not doing that, if you're not automating your processes, you can't. And it's super interesting to see in training how there's this divide where like, oh, it's all about vision. It's all about grip. It's all about whatever. Guys, it isn't. It's simply build your structure, your fundamentals, then start applying practicality and start building into tactical environment. Because if you can't do the mechanical stuff, then the tactical stuff doesn't really matter. We talk about it. This HEB security team, we talk to them. They train up on the north side of town. And I said, hey, guys, what's the average length of an aisle in HEB? And they're like, oh, that's like 33 yards. How many people in any given class are going to be like, hey, we're going to put a headshot at 33 yards, and you have to do it right now. There's no cover. There's no nothing. You're standing in the middle of an aisle at HEB. You got to do it. How many people would raise their hand and be like, I can do that 100% of the time?
Yeah, that was something I found interesting whenever we were talking to like school resource officers or whenever agencies were looking for rifle quotes for school security. And you know, people think in terms of like, you know, CQB, like within a classroom or something. How long is a school hallway?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, a school hallway is, in some schools, that's a significant distance.
Maybe 100 yards.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the aisles at Walmart. That's why I call those long shots that we do at in our courses, the Walmart shots, because how long are the aisles at Walmart? You know, even they're probably about 75, maybe 100 yards, you know. And so if you don't have the capability to go ahead and press the trigger without disturbing the sights and hit what you need to hit, then that's a problem, right?
There's no tactic that's going to save you there.
Right.
You can't ninja roll your way out
absolutely,
of that.
Absolutely, absolutely. So that's the LPBO class this weekend was really, really good, and it was eye-opening. You can see the students before on the – like when they started doing the shoot, move, and communicate – you can tell they were juiced up. The adrenaline was dumping, and they were...
That was fun, man, when I did. I took that class.
Yeah.
That was a fun drill at the end.
Yeah. So that's kind of the premise behind it. So the POI is based on that drill right there, and I extract all the skill sets necessary to really be successful on that drill. And, like, we had one student, they're like... the Lonnie, he's like, oh, we got to do CQB. I thought it was a LPBO class. Like, well, we got to do the CQB stuff first. We got to see how your gun handling skills are, ready up drills. Because, again, the biggest thing that we see students coming into our courses, they come in with a nice rifle, a nice optic, and then bipod legs. And then after maybe the first couple of hours, that bipod leg goes away because... Again, they don't understand that this is a combat rifle. It's not a static position. It's not a sniper system. This is a combat rifle. You should be able to fire maneuver. And the LPBO, what it does, it gives you the capability to really see out the distance and engage those targets at the distance. But at the same time, it has red dot and it's got one power. You're able to, if you train really, really good at it, be able to engage targets at CQB distances without any loss of capability.
Mm-hmm. What distances do y'all go out to for most of these classes? And then my second question is, our listenership has varying levels. I mean, there's everybody from like true badasses up to guys that are novices just getting into it. What distance would you suggest somebody zero in LPBO?
After we introduced ourselves as instructors, we asked the students like, hey, tell me a little bit about yourself, what kind of gun you're running, and what kind of zero you're running. A lot of them had 100 yards, and then we go through zero, like we have a 1 hour block of instruction on the LPBO zeros, but I do recommend 50 yards. We had students that were 100 yards, and then we zeroed them at 50 yards, and then he came back, it's like, oh my God, I really love that 50-yard zero. But other side of the spectrum, right, you got to look at your owner's manual. So depending on the LPVO that you have, the LPVO has a recommended zero based on, like, the engineering and the stuff that the erectors and all that stuff. I can't speak intelligently on that. But you got to look at your owner's manual. But the zero that we recommend is 50/200 yards. It's really, really good zero.
I just like that you said erector. So I'll counterpoint on the other end of that. I'm pretty technical, analytical person when it comes to the shooting process and how we talk about zeros. Your zero is your zero, right? A lot of people are like, yeah, I have a 50/200. I'm like, really? Let's shoot at 200 and see where you are. Because that 50/200 yard zeros with a 14.5 with M855 in specific conditions, that's close, right? Well, you're shooting 11.5 with 77 grain. It's not the same. That's not a 5200 anymore, right? You got to know what your equipment, your ammo, whatever you're going to select, and you got to confirm that, because if you want to be serious about it and take the priority of this gun needs to be ready for a duty presentation to save my life or somebody else's life or to protect my fellow officers, whatever, then you better know, right? There's no, you know, wishing well that you can throw a quarter into and be like, this will be good enough, bang.
Not just know, but check it. You know, we got a lot of guys, I get out to class, it's like, oh, my rifle's zeroed, and then we've had that here at our range days with our guys, we're like, oh, it's zeroed, and they get out there and take some shots, they're like, nope, not even
sure
close.
Isn't.
Yeah, that,
but I've dropped it since then.
Or yeah, I know. That,
whatever.
That ours, like, that's the first thing we do before we do anything is we confirm zero, and some of the guys are like, oh, yeah, yeah, I zeroed, and then you're going like, man, your zero is way off. And so we really, really harp on the importance of having a really good zero. You have to be proud of that zero, because if you don't have a good zero, you're going to, and you say it's good enough. When you go out the distance and you start missing, you start figuring out like, oh man, I really should have paid a lot more attention on my zero, because now I'm wasting time, I'm wasting ammo, I'm wasting energy. So we really harp on the importance of having a really, really good zero. As a matter of fact, yesterday, I was talking to Lonnie again, he was missing a lot. It's very frustrating as an instructor to see a student struggling after we already zeroed. So I got behind the gun and confirmed that the zero was way off. I just did a Kentucky windage adjustment on the turret and moved the turret three clicks to the right, and then got behind the gun, shot it. Boom, center mass on the 200 yards.
Lonnie moved it 10 clicks.
After Lonnie moved it, and then Lonnie moved it, like, yeah. But yeah, that's important to have a good zero. And then one more thing I about the zero, like, you got to look at what your application is, right? You know, what kind of application, and what are you trying to accomplish here? The military has the Army has 25-meter zero. The Marines and I think the SEALs use a 36-yard zero. There's a purpose and there's a concept behind that. You need to understand what they're trying to accomplish. And I think if you understand the mechanics of what zero is, that's going to go ahead and drive your decision-making process a little bit better. So for what I do, I compete and I can shoot out the distance. To answer your second question, the distance on the ranges is dependent on the range. And today we only this weekend we only had 400 yards, but in Virginia we had 500 yards. And we're shooting out maybe 8-inch gongs at 500 yards, and we get our students that have never shot past 400 yards, and then at the end of the day they're hitting that thing pretty consistently.
No, that's a good feeling. I see it. I mean, as a rifle maker, whenever you see somebody that's never really pushed their rifle or really kind of started to explore what that rifle's capabilities are. And you see somebody with an 11.5 and they're very confident taking a 500-yard shot, you know, because in their mind, you know, you need a 20-inch barrel for that. Like, no, I mean, like, your 11.5 will get you there just fine. Matter of fact, I'd be damn concerned if you couldn't. You know what I mean? You know,
the weapon's like, capable,
like,
for sure.
The rifle's capable of doing that. And then it's awesome to see somebody who hasn't done that before, and then, like, you can see, like, that confidence in the equipment and in themselves. That's a very satisfying feeling.
It is.
To see that, you know?
Really see the lights come on and be like, yes, this is what I wanted it to be, or I found the way to make it what it needed to be, like, figured out my zero, figured out the process. And we tell students, like, 400 yards is really not that far, guys. Like, it's a ways, but it's not that far. We're not shooting, you know, 1,200, 1,300, 1,400 yards. This is 400 yards. Mm-hmm. Your carbine is more than capable of it. I mean, even a standard 5,200 yard zero on an actual 14.5, your 300 is only, you know, 6-8 whatever inches below your center group of that
correct
zero. So yeah. If you know your holds, and this is the thing, we do this super intense amount of accuracy focus when we're out there. Like, even on a full size steel plate, we're watching at 60 power through spotting scopes, and they're like, "Ding! Oh, I hit it!" I'm like, "Yeah, but you were in the belly button, bro.
Yeah,
let's bring it up a third of a target. What's your hold there?" That's where you need to be. And then we pushed them out and started shooting 8-inch gongs at 400 yards, and they were like, I'm never going to hit this. I had people in the back, they're like, nope, not happening. And then you watch them, and they start seeing it. And we're watching the trace, and they're like, holding, you know, 2-3 targets high. I'm like, guys, it's not that far.
Mm-hmm.
Come on back down. And then they start hitting, and they're like, man, I'm way more capable than I thought it was. The gun's way more capable than I thought it was. And that level of confidence and competence in your equipment, that's irreplaceable.
Yeah,
that's the training.
Very satisfying as an instructor. And then so we do it on day one, and day two, they come in early in the morning and they do warm up. And I mean, you can see the difference between the previous day and then the next day. And I started increasing the complexity of the target arrays. Because what I'll do is like, hey guys, listen up, bring it in. You guys are going to search for this drill. We're going to shoot targets 5, 3, 2, 1. I'm just made that up, but just an example. And then they're like, all right, you got 2 minutes, and I'll call out the first three shooters. And then next thing you know, man, they're crushing it. Some of them, we had a guy that crushed it and like in 29 seconds,
23 seconds.
23 seconds, and it's two hits on steel, not just one, because one could be a fluke. Two, it's confirmed that you actually are holding correctly. And then that dude crushed it. So yeah.
Five to six different target arrays from 90 to 400 yards, and he ran it fast. I mean, he was just on the gun, doing what he needed to do. And that ability to throw your ego out, because a lot of people come to classes and they're like, oh, I'm going to add to what I know. Tools in the toolbox. Guys, sometimes you need to throw that shit out. Sometimes you think you know something and you're trying to throw our magic on top of your whatever it is, and you're not getting the result you want. You're so confused and frustrated by it because you're not willing to throw your ego aside and say, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do exactly what they told me. I'm going to do exactly what they ask, and I'm going to do that thing only. And when you do that and you get the result, suddenly you go, oh, why? What have I been doing the whole time?
Yeah, I always try to pick up something from each class. Jeff Gonzalez is a good example because like his grip and some of the things he teaches are very different than what other people do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, well, I'm going to do it Jeff's way during the class. And I was like, if I take it with me afterwards, then I do. But, you know, at least try it, like you're saying, try it the instructor's way. And, you know, Jedi, when I started, took his class, you know, that's, he taught, everybody has their own grip, and that's the one I ended up sticking with.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, and if it doesn't work when you leave, you go home, man, like, you know, tell me to, you know, suck it. Cool. I you paid the money already.
At least try it.
Be open minded. Right. And just to add to that, like, not saying that students are bad, but the problem is that students come in and just like Matt said, they think they know how to shoot and they just come with tons of bad habit. And then like to rework all those bad habits and retrain that individual versus somebody that's brand new, that doesn't know nothing. And they just open minded and they just soak it up and Andrew's like crushing it because they don't know any better. Cause now they're being taught like the right way right from the get go. Mm-hmm. So that makes a big, big, big difference.
You know, like now, like Pressburg, like part of some of his method, like for like the no fail, in his mind, he's throwing. I'm probably gonna fuck this up. Dude. You guys can correct me, but you know, technique and everything aside, all that matters is the results. All that matters is that bullet going where you're telling it to do.
He doesn't really teach. I've taken that class. Yeah, he doesn't really teach grip or anything like that. Like he's up to you to do what works.
Yep.
Yeah. So
expecting the outcome. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not necessarily like the. I mean, some classes I guess probably focus on technique, whereas some are just trying to get you to get the results. I guess for an instructor, it's probably a bit. I don't know. You guys weigh in. I mean, is it frustrating in a sense because you have such a limited amount of time and you have like usually like maybe a 10-1 or 15-1 like student to instructor ratio, so you don't have like a ton of time to like really take super corrective.
No, so greenhouse. That's one of the biggest. Shout out to Mike and Pascal because one of the biggest the best feedbacks that we get, it's the instructor to student ratio. Yeah. So like for instance, this weekend. We had myself, Matt, Gustav, and Brooke.
Oh, that's
Brooke.
Awesome.
And Brooke. That's so really, now you have like these super seasoned, experienced, operational dudes that they come from little different backgrounds, right? And they do we do the same things. We might do them just a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. So when they make that, they give that feedback to the student, maybe what I'm saying is not clicking with them, but maybe the way Matt says it, it clicks with them, and then now they're off to the races and they're running it hard. So, so we really don't have we have actual protocol. So
that's awesome.
If we have 10 plus students, that's automatically two instructors. Mm-hmm. 15 students, three instructors, and then 20, it's like for sure four instructors because you have to have eyes on all the time.
Yeah, Mike and Pascal they'll lose money on a class to put enough instructors on the line. They don't care. Like the quality of the product for us is what matters.
Yep.
And it seems like a bad business decision when you think about it. Students come back and they're like, I don't understand how we get so much individual attention. How like every single time, and it's not just that we're walking up and we're like, hey, good job, right? It's always feedback. There's always something to improve on. There's always something, giving some small tweak, some little thing. And you don't want to overload students. If you give them 15 things in one sitting, you're like, hey, your grip's messed up. You're not pressing the trigger correctly. Your feet are in the wrong place. You're moving your head and your whole upper body while you move the gun. Like, if you do that, they're going to hear the first two and then it's over. Yeah. Like, they can't process that. But if you give it to them over 2 days, every little time you come back and you click off one little thing or two little things, and you build a repertoire that includes a skill set now where it doesn't matter what the student is, you've got the tools. You can diagnose anything. You can deal with anyone. And I see it as a challenge almost rather than like a detriment to the class to have students that are difficult to teach.
Yeah, that's for sure. And then, you know, the added benefit of that or the return on investment is that they get actual feedback. So guess what you're going to get? You're going to get repeat customers. They're going to come back to class. Hey, what's the next thing? Or maybe I didn't do that good on that defensive pistol one class. So let me go back to the house, dry fire, get some training, and come back and recrush it again and see how, because, you know, I got a buddy of mine. His name is Jason Kelly, and he's really all about the reps. And he's got the sayings that the message is hidden in the reps. The more you do it, you're like, oh, man, that light bulb will come up. You're like, oh, I understand why X, Y, and Z happened, because you're doing it so much and now it's starting to make sense. So
that comes from, you know, the opposite side of that for me is a lot of people will tell you, hey, it takes 10,000 repetitions to secure a skill set, right? You got to do it 10,000 times perfectly, slowly, and smoothly. Well, if that's the case, and this is not to directly shit on any instructor, but if you're doing this, stop. If you tell your students, hey, you're not going to get, you know, this technique because you got to do 10,000 reps. It's a cop out as an instructor, because you're not going to do 10,000 reps in my class, so you're not going to get better. So what incentive do I have to really push you to improve? Like, I'm just going to shoot supervised drills. If I'm giving you a technique, it works right now, and it should. If it doesn't, then it's not the correct technique. And that's the thing I love about shooting and teaching is you can't fake the funk. If you're not putting rounds where they need to go fast and accurately, then you're not doing it. And that metric right there, that speed and accuracy coming from, you know, my mentorship and the guys that I've learned with, like, they say it the best, like, your resume is not a metric. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter what you do. If you can't shoot, if you can't perform every time on command, pick up the gun and do it, then you got work to do.
Let me ask you guys, what have y'all seen in terms of the trend? I mean, the last few years, I can tell you from the gun industry in terms of who's buying our... Remember, we market hard-use rifles to people who actually shoot. We, you know, endurance rifles, right? We're not a... Typically, people graduate to a Sons Liberty rifle. Typically, you know, someone's had something else, and then they took it to a class, they had issues, they upgrade to a Sons Liberty rifle so just to get that performance. I have noticed that the demographics of our clientele have changed dramatically over the last 3 years. And the caricature of what you might expect, you know, who's buying these guns, has changed dramatically. There does seem to be a trend where more people are taking their defense more seriously. Are y'all seeing that on the training side too? Are you seeing fresh groups of faces, you know, students that have never been to class? This is my first time at a carbine course. I mean, are y'all seeing that trend in the training side too?
Yeah, for sure. We had a couple students that never taken a green ops class, and next you know, they're thrown into the LPBO class, which is a little advanced, you know, not the actual shooting part, but the last part, right? The shoot, move, and communicate, and then, like Matt talking about automating the gun. So yeah, a lot of guys, you got to look at what's going on in the United States right now. All this, the violence, law enforcement is overworked. You as a citizen have to take responsibility and control of your own security, not depend on the government. And so that's why I really do the that shoot, move, and communicate portion at the end, because I want our citizens to have a basic understanding of what it takes to do that sort of a thing. You think you're just because you're, you know, you're plucking, you know, holes at 10 yards with a bullseye, that you're going to be sufficient. There's much more than that. And to also answer your question, the demographic that we've seen, I'm not from Texas. I'm from the Northern Virginia area. And so people think that I live in Maryland, that Maryland's not a gun state, but holy crap, there's a whole bunch of shooters there. The community out there of shooters is impressive. A lot of the guys that we have coming to our courses are work for the federal government, work, you know, doing IT stuff. Like, and those guys have, you know, they have good resources, they have a lot of money, so they come to our classes with some really Gucci guns, and we see them. And then the other aspect of it, Green Ops is highly into the competition arena. So when we come out there, man, we see sometimes our students, and so we like to see them progress. And sometimes they'll even squad with us. Well, I mean, we encourage competition shooting, because there's a lot that you can transfer from competition shooting into the practical and tactical world. Sure.
That was one of the things that really opened my eyes over the last few years. Whenever, you know, I've seen a dramatic increase in female shooters, on the rifle, you know, where like female shooters are really, you know, kind of embracing the rifle, or people that have historically never really been interested in guns. I mean, I have friends contact me I haven't talked to in 20 years that have never really owned a gun, that now all of a sudden feel some level of need to have some type of means of self-defense. And I'm hoping that as you see the rise of gun ownership, that we're also seeing the rise of people
training.
And I'm encouraged to hear that that's what you guys are seeing.
So two part for me, first off, I mean, we have a different perspective here being in Texas, having less instructors here. I have three instructors that work with me right now, but we've seen, especially for myself, having done it by myself quite a bit. We had a real estate agent that we used when we first moved here to Texas, and she's extremely liberal-minded politically. And in 2021, she called my wife and was like, hey, I need to get in touch with your husband. Can you give me his number? And she called me, and she was like, hey, I see you're doing firearms training. Me and my husband just went and bought guns. I'm terrified for my life, because she'd been assaulted while she was showing a house. So she went to check on a house and got assaulted in the house by squatters that were living in the house. So that's one example. She wanted training. She went and bought guns. And now her perspective has changed dramatically. Like, the things that I see her post, the way she talks about it, very different. Same thing, had private students from Austin come down. Historically, super liberal. His wife does, like, holistic health treatment, and he's a musician, and super nice people. But he was like, I never thought I'd need a gun. I never wanted guns. I was disgusted by the firearms culture. And then I found out, you know, hey, maybe the government isn't the one that's going to take care of me. And that's a shift that I've seen across here, especially between Austin, New Braunfels. There's a lot of liberal-leaning mentality in that part of the state, where people are coming to their senses and being like, look, I can't depend on anyone. The cops aren't coming. Mm-hmm. During the riots, you couldn't call the 911. There were no cops coming. There's no ambulance coming. And that shift has been huge. Like you mentioned, Mike, a lot more female students in classes. They're, you know, sort of coming in like unsure, unaware, and then you hand them a skill set or the beginnings of a skill set, and that confidence just blooms. They're completely happy with it. And then on the other side, we have students coming in that think they're shooters, that, you know, they show up in Cry Precision pants and a $5,000 rifle and equipment and belt and everything. And by the end of it, the next time I see them 6 months down the road, they're carrying concealed, they're shooting a, you know, basic Glock with a red dot and a light, or
they're wearing regular pants.
Yeah, they've got jeans on and Converse or something, and they're out on the range. I'm like, guys, stop. Like, not to say if you got the money and you want to buy equipment, absolutely buy a Sons of Liberty gun, because you'll feel better, right? You'll be a great American. Just move up in the world. Stop buying trash. But on the other side of it, like, you need that investment in yourself. And if you're looking at the culture and the community that we have now, and the state of the world and the state of this country, when the shit goes down, each other's all we've got. That's it, man. There's no one to run to. There's nowhere to go. We've got to take care of each other. And if we can build more competent students and shooters and citizens, that's what I'm here for.
I'm glad. I kind of set this question up because I had an idea of what I thought the answer might be, you know, just from what we've seen. And I want to remind people, because I know there's this tendency, like, to romanticize the past, but like the good old days of whenever gun ownership was, you know, like there was less NFA restrictions, like before the, you know, 1934, you know, or, you know, before the Hughes Amendment of 1986 and so on and so forth. Trust me, I oppose all of that legislation. I think the overwhelming majority of gun law in general is a mistake. Yeah. But with that being said, the truth of the matter, the reality is, never before in the history of the Republic have more of our citizens been armed. There are more, there are like, you know, I read an article that, civilian ownership of guns in the U.S. has passed 500 million. So think about that. There's about a billion guns globally. Half of all the guns in the world are here in the United States in commercial or civilian ownership. More people have, you know, guns designed for defense. More people have ARs and semi-automatic rifles and handguns than ever before in our nation's history. And more people are investing in, you know, the right sling or optic or light or, you know, hell, armor, night vision. If you look at the night vision ownership just within a 200-mile radius of San Antonio, our hog hunters, we probably have better and more night vision than like the majority of the Russian infantry. And that's just the truth by numbers and through commercial sales. So the people romanticize about the past. I'll tell you right now, there's never been a time where you have a better armed populace. And again, seeing our friends in the training community, there are a lot of capable people out there and they're getting more and more and more capable. And I feel that's a good thing overall for the health of society.
Well, to caveat that on the equipment side, from equipment to training, never before have we had the quality and level and availability of training that we do now.
Like that's thanks to 20 years in the global war on terrorism.
Right. There's so many guys out there now that, like Chuck Pressburg, guys that came out of that, Bill Blauer is coming out of that. You know, that this, it's my predecessors in this generation of instructors that they built this. Like, I'm standing on the shoulders of giants, but now we're seeing this explosion of quality instructors. There's so many people out there giving great instruction and great application to that tool set. That's never, it's never been as viable now or as it is now.
Like, the truth is like, I mean, you know, all of us that are like embedded into this culture, we know this to be true. I would argue that there are a lot of civilians, there are a lot of citizens that have invested way more time in firearms training than the vast majority of entire police departments.
Military.
Yeah. I mean, you know, unless you're in combat arms or unless you're
Not even combat arms. I would say if you're in the special operation forces, that's probably the highest. Because even, I mean, they're getting a lot better, you know. But if you look at a soldier that graduates basic training in AIT, he's only shooting out the 300 meters. Like, we get civilians now that in 2 days are able to have the capability with an LPBO to shoot out the 500 yards on an 8-inch gong. Like, yeah, you see what I'm saying?
I mean, there's significant amounts of police officers on departments that qualify once or twice a year, or they'll do an in-service.
Yep.
I mean, and then there are civilians that I know that take, that are either shooting competitions weekly,
yep,
or they're taking carbine classes and they're shooting thousands and thousands of rounds a year. I mean, that's pretty amazing, the capability of the citizenry that have invested the time and absolutely the energy to go do it.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and start.
To give that perspective, we just had a conversation earlier from a good friend of ours who worked in Mexican federal law enforcement, that there are officers in Mexico that might shoot 50 rounds in their entire career.
Yeah.
That context and perspective, like, guys, I shot, I don't know, 7,000 rounds the last 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
What's the average in the U.S.? I've heard somewhere between 350 and 500 rounds a year, maybe. That'd be a fairly, like, prolific shooter.
Yeah.
I mean, I think in 2019, I counted up just in 9mm, I shot 25,000 rounds. And that's not even that high. There are competition shooters that shoot hundreds of thousands of rounds a year.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. To backtrack, the night vision stuff, I want to kind of talk about that. I just recently did the RPGI day-night match. The match director, Brandon Saunders, is also a former 7th Group warrant officer that worked at the Crescent Response Force, the CRIF, and retired and created this day-night match where the first time he came down to West Virginia to Shadow Hawk, maybe had 40, maybe 30, 20, 30, 40 shooters, something like that. He came back again, increased a little bit. This last match, which is about two weeks ago, 150 shooters, okay? And then the squad in front of us, which are all civilians, all had nods, all of them. PVS-31s, they're all camoed out, they're civilians. I mean, they're not great, but yeah, for sure, we saw a lot of that. The night vision has proliferated all around. So it's to the point now where I need to go ahead and invest, because now there's a market for it. Like, every citizen now is trying to get the MVGs and the mounts and the lasers and all that stuff. When I did it, I shot it all white light. Why? Because I'm a civilian now, and I want to be able to practice the way I carry, right? So I'm manipulating that light switch on my weapon mounted light. So that's the reason why I do that. But yeah, there are civilians out there, especially like in our area, man, there's a lot of shooters, and they're really, really, really good.
Oh yeah. I mean, even just watching my buddies that are, you know, not, I mean, just the guys that manage predator control, that manage some of this stuff. I mean, you're watching guys nightly just go out, you know, it's kind of like a hobby almost. They're engaging in 400 or 500 yard, you know, shots under thermal or night vision nightly, you know, on there's not many places to get that level of formal instruction, and, you know, unless you have a real, real need for it. I mean, it's just crazy to see how everything is kind of coming up like this. You know, suppressor ownership has never been higher. You know, this is stuff like that. That's just,
you know, you think the Japanese in World War II were worried about, they're like, there's going to be a gun behind every blade of grass or whatever. I'm like, what do you think is going to happen now?
Yeah, there's guys.
There's going to be some dude gooned out in his tall socks and his cargo shorts with some PBS 31s. He's wearing a car loan on his head, and he's about to yeet you.
Yeah, go to one of these drone club meetings one day, and you realize, man, I mean, like, you know, I would bet that our country is capable of responding to even like drone warfare now, just from the hobbyists that are out there fucking around. I mean, it's a wild time to be alive, man. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you what.
And I tell a lot of people, like, man, how fortunate we are here in the United States, where we can just go to a gun shop, you know, depending on the state, go get your gun, go get ammo. Like Matt was talking about, one of our friends from Mexico, who's an ex-federal police, like he's got his own private security firm. And in order for him to be legal to have guns, he's got to buy it from one spot only in Mexico, and it's the military. And oh, by the way, it's not like, hey, I want a Sons of Liberty gun. It's like, hey, what do you got there? Oh, we only have CCP-10s and SP-07. Well, okay, I'll take it. So legal gun ownership in other parts of the world, it's very restrictive versus here in the United States. How fortunate we are that we have the Second Amendment, where, you know, we can just go into a gun shop, again, depending on the state, you can come out with a gun that same day and go buy some ammo, and now you are protected. At least you have a gun, right? Versus, like I said, Mexico, if you want to be a legal firearms owner, and let's say you live in Baja California, you got to fly all the way up to Mexico City to the military, put all the forms, bribe everybody and their mother to get a gun, and then you're illegal. And by the way, you can only get 380 and below, because 9mm and 5.56 and all that stuff is illegal.
I remember having this conversation with people at the very start of the Ukrainian, you know, situation, and, you know, they it was a very publicized thing where they were handing out weapons to the civilian populace, because they're, you know, you're expecting block to block, you know, street to street, you know, fighting. It dawned on me, like, nobody's ever going to have to just hand out rifles in the U.S.
No.
like that's never going to happen.
I don't want your trash, Bushmaster. Get out of here.
Yeah. It's like that would never happen here. And furthermore, or at least not in the our region, right? And then furthermore, there was this interest. There was a very public push against gun companies in the Second Amendment through the administration during that time. At the same time, behind the scenes, what people didn't realize was they were expediting every single approval for export to guns going to these conflict zones, not for military, but for, you know, Ukrainian civilians. And that, I remember being very frustrated at that, because, you know, unfortunately, like, a lot of the most vocal supporters of the Ukrainian resistance are the same people who are very reluctant to see private gun ownership in the United States. I don't know how you reconcile those two beliefs. How can you be so adamant about wanting to support and arm the Ukrainian citizenry whenever you're at the same trying to disarm the Americans? If you don't think that something crazy can happen here, I want you to turn your eyes to the southern border and look at just some of, like, the unbiased, unpolitical, nonpartisan data of how many people have come across the southern border in the last 5 years. It's estimated between 8 to 10 million. And if you don't think that, like, I don't know, 10,000 people might have bad intentions, mm-hmm. pretty low, you know, it's a pretty low percentage of that. How much damage could 10,000
considering
people,
six dudes destroyed the entire electrical infrastructure in Southern California by just shooting transformers and stuff?
Yeah, I mean, or how many people were in Mumbai? You know, or how many people, you know, paraglided into Israel?
I was about to say that, yeah. And I mean, look at Israel. Like, the citizens, I think they're not allowed to own guns, right? No. And so when they infiltrated that border, like, they were defenseless. And then they had to go relegate to go into their panic room to go get secured. And I mean, they got smoked out anyway, so...
And just for the record for our listeners, I'm saying this in a non-political, non-partisan type of way. I'm saying, like, it's just a matter of how many people have come here, how many of them could potentially have bad intentions, and there's no police force that I'm aware of that is necessarily geared up to deal with maybe 5-10 active scenarios in one city at one time. There's only so many EMSs in your city, and it's not as many as you think. There's only so many, you know, SWAT members in your city, and it's probably not as many as in San Antonio, a city of, you know, what, almost 2 million people. We're the 7th largest city in the country. At any given time, I think there's like 130 police officers on duty at any given time. Now, 10 angry people that are motivated, that'd be a hard thing to deal with in a densely populated area.
And what about 50 or 100? You know, you're going to call in that. Even if there's 2,000 police officers from every rank and file, from the captain down to the clerks, you're going to call all of them out? Say 6,000 people are involved?
That'd be a hell of a time to rob a bank, wouldn't it? I mean,
nobody's coming.
Nobody's coming.
Nobody's
right?
coming.
I mean, but this idea of stability is kind of an illusion. This idea of surplus, right? You go to the grocery store and you want a box of Lucky Charms, and it's always in the exact same spot every time. And it feels like there's surplus, but really what it is that the store is so efficient that they're selling the last box of Lucky Charms right as the truck to deliver the next box is pulling up, right? People don't realize that all it takes is for that first truck to stop.
Yep.
On-time delivery, babe.
All it takes is for that to stop, or for, you know, just some type of disruption in some type of grid. And, like, this thing, this is, like, our way of life would be dramatically altered very, very quickly. And that's why, again, I think more people are being cognizant of that. That's why you're seeing more people getting prepared. I bet you if we were to – we should have some guest on one of these days, Kyle, from, like, the – water purification side of the industry, prep kind of guys, generator salesman. I bet you it's similar.
Get Mike Glover. I think he has gardening.
We should have Mike on.
I mean, he's really, like, he's owned that space now since he's, like, the preparedness space where. So.
I have a buddy that's an instructor at Darcy that's also named Mike Glover. We should have him on at the same time just because it'd be funny.
It'd be confusing.
He's a retired ranger. Yeah, it'd be funny.
Now, Darcy Glover. What is
much younger? Yeah, he just got out of Ranger Bat, and I think he was only in for like 6-8 years. He's a good dude, but yeah, not.
Is he more the firearm side instruction?
Yeah.
I always get that confused when I hear people talking. I'm like,
I think his primary thing is teaching Tusk, which is their civilian survival class, but the designated marksman side of it. So,
and so
that's
me,
a great class.
And
people
so me,
should do that.
You know, so me as like what I used to do in the military, we used to go to different countries and do foreign internal defense. Go to different countries. My rationale is, like, after I retire, is like, why can't we have an American foreign internal defense?
Yeah.
And that's kind of been my mission set to teach guys not only the firearms portion, the flat range drills, but maybe the mindset and the tactics. I'm just a little bit of tax in there so they can kind of see what they're missing out on or what they're capable of. And so that's really
the only reason most people in the United States behave and don't break the law is because it's in their best interest to do that. You know what I mean? As soon as we're all about to starve, it's in my best interest to fucking eat. So
no, I've seen it. I have been in disaster areas where you watch how rapidly it devolves, right? Day one, there's this attitude of like, hey, we're all in this together. You know? day three, it's like, you know what? This is my water. And and I'm just going to, you know, like, I'm just going to kind of like, you know, keep it for myself. Day five, motherfucker, I'm coming to take your water.
Yeah.
and that is legitimately about the timeline for how fast things devolve. We're not all in this together. I mean, you know, perhaps if you have like a network of folks that you can kind of count on, but as far as if you're looking for like the goodness of your fellow man, wait till the fucking water runs out.
Yeah, so by day five, you eat your neighbor's food. By day 15, you eat your neighbor.
Yeah, right. So Mike mentioned something earlier talking about like this whole concept of it. I want to ask people that are on the other side of the aisle. I mean, they're probably not listening, right? I would guess that they're not going looking for Sons of Liberty podcast. But if you hear it, please, God, think about it. If you're willing to send weapons to the Ukraine, but you're willing to disarm your neighbor, and not yourself, you're not going to go to his house and take his guns, but you'll send some proxy agent of the government to his house and potentially kill him and his family, which, guys, this is not anti-government, but it has happened. You know, if you call and you send somebody a red flag or whatever, there's incidents in history that it has happened. But you're willing to do that. What is your mentality? What is your morality? What's your ethical compass? Or do you even have one? Have you even thought about it? So please realize that, well, after day five, we may not be in this together. For right now, we are. And I'm hoping that you guys will realize that and recognize that we're not here. If there was a problem with gun violence in this country with 500 million guns, you'd know.
Mm-hmm. Well, whenever I want to put this in context, when I say that more and more people are invested in the right equipment and training and preparedness and mindset and thinking about this kind of stuff, when I say more people are doing that than ever before, that is true, mm-hmm. but it's also still a tiny fraction of people in general.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you look at, you know, like the CDC, when they used to publish certain studies about what would happen with a grid failure or something, it's estimated like 80% of the population along the eastern seaboard would be dead within 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Not from, you know, some type, not from like a nuclear blast or some type of, you know, like, you know, meteor. I'm talking about from fucking starvation and
internal violence.
Yeah, you know, hypothermia and just internal violence, and then also like dehydration. Like, just 80% of the people there would be dead within 2 weeks if you did not have means to, like, well, I don't know, like go into the tap and it, you know, something coming out. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Never mind if you need insulin. Well, yeah, and there's no power to refrigerate it.
That's what I'm saying.
You're going to die.
Heart medication, you know, yeah. If you're catheters, if you're on dialysis, like, you know, people don't think about, like, again, this idea of stability in our way of life is so fucking fragile, and it's such an illusion of like, oh, well, this is so easy. Like, man, wait till that first fucking truck doesn't show up, man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the candy crust on the ball of shit that everybody's hammering at. And I think the thing people don't understand, too, is, like, the ones that are calling for revolution and we need to overthrow the system, y'all are going to die, too. You're not immune, the first ones, too, right?
I've had this conversation on a few podcasts, and there are people out there who incorrectly believe that an armed populace could not radically change our way of life quickly. In other words, there are people out there that think, oh, you have an AR-15, who cares? The government has a stealth bomber. No. An armed if 1% of people just stopped obeying traffic laws, society would come to a screeching halt right mm-hmm. away.
I mean, they always talk about, you know, we're always, oh, the martial law, this, that, and the other. I mean, how many troops did we have in Iraq trying to control fucking Iraq? Like 300,000? Mm-hmm. Like, you think you could control, like, South Texas, let alone the entire freaking country? Like, good luck.
I think
good luck.
I mean, the Taliban, I think, at maximum force had 80,000 fighters in an area that was geographically roughly the size of Texas. You know, and I can tell you that, like, the people currently in power in Afghanistan are not the dudes with the stealth bomber. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so, but what I mean there is, like, there are people that incorrectly believe that an armed populace could not radically alter the way things are. They are completely wrong. The other side of the coin are people that somehow think that an armed conflict here on our soil would somehow result in something better than we currently have. And I also think that is a bit incorrect. I mean, of course, you know, we all of us here believe in the Second Amendment. We believe that that is a real and unfortunate option that we have as Americans. But if you romanticize that, and if you're looking forward to the day where that happens, I can tell you there are not two Americas. There are 5,000 Americas. And if you're looking for, like, one side versus another side, that is highly idealistic, and that is not going to happen. What you're going to have is tiny factions of people fighting for survival, and it's not going to – what we have right now is going to be infinitely better than what it would look like if we were living in Mad Max. That's why I wish more people would just talk to each other before the shooting starts.
And that's the problem. You're right. When the talking stops, that's when shooting starts, right? If we're not talking to each other, we're not communicating. And it's funny because I've had, like, this conversation with people who are hyper-liberal prior to getting introduced to firearms, and they come in and they're like, they still have some of that vestige of this, like, left-wing mindset. They're like, oh, well, we need, you know, government programs for this or that. I'm like, guys, if you don't trust the government to do this thing over here, why do you trust it for all of this? right? You're telling me that they're propaganda blowing up in your face and they're trying to take your guns away, but we need them to run healthcare? Like, I don't know. It just seems so...
That's an interesting... I mean, like, I've been wrestling with this for the last 2 or 3 years. Like, mm-hmm. we've lost so much confidence in our institutions. But I'm not necessarily sure you should abandon the institutions. I wonder if it would be better... I mean, ultimately, the optimal thing to do would be to fix it. Like, it would be nice to restore confidence in, like, I don't know, the way we feel about elections. I would rather restore confidence in elections than to do away...
100%. 100%.
I mean, should an FBI exist, you know, in the most pure sense of what it might have been intended to do? Like, you know, perhaps it should it be highly politicized and weaponized? Like, no. So I don't know if doing away with the institutions is the answer, or if we could ever get back to a point where the institutions are run by the people for the people.
But that's, you know, the hard thing, right?
Kind of confidence.
Just like with anything else in life, humans are like, oh, it's broken, I could fix it, but no, I'm just going to throw it away, right? It's so much easier because it's hard to fix it. Like, look at the institution, how complex, like you mentioned, there's going to be 5,000 Americas. How many groups of people have different interests and different thoughts and different, you know, hopes for legislation, regulation, all these things? How do you coalesce all that into a common vision?
The joke that I used to always say is that you and I can agree on 95% of our entire worldview, but we're going to shoot it out over that last 5%.
Absolutely.
And that's being highly optimistic that we got to 95%. I can think of plenty of people where I don't agree with fucking 3% of your worldview. Yeah. So
I mean, I've been called a Nazi over, you know, one concept, right? One viewpoint, right?
You are here dressed as Hitler, dude.
Am I? I'm just kidding. Is it the mustache?
No, no. Hey, it's audio only, so you can't tell it. I'm just joking. I'm just joking.
It's a power mustache.
I went to go buy tequila the other day, and there's a kid at the liquor store that had like a black ring in his nose, but from more than 20 feet away, it looked like he had a fucking Hitler mustache. Oh, I was like, does this kid look in the mirror? Like,
oh no. He doesn't have any friends. They would have told him.
But, you know, to hit on the institutions, right? You were talking about the FBI. Like, I know a lot of agents, and man, they're just great people, man. And they're the guys on the ground. I think if you want to make a change, it's got to stop. Just start at the top and then replace the whole leadership and stop politicizing these law enforcement agencies, and then just do exactly what they're needed to do and just stay mission focus on keeping the populace safe and not actually going after our citizens. Yep. So I think it starts right there, man. And I live in D.C., so it's a really, 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 really bad swamp. And then another point that they were talking about, so during the COVID era, I had this husband and wife couple that came and took a private lesson with me. And they were a little bit older. When I say older, maybe in like the late 30s, early 40s. And I'm like, hey, man, can I ask you a question? Like, I always ask a private lesson, why? What's the purpose? Why are you taking this class? And by the way, this couple, both of them were lawyers and very liberal in D.C. And the gentleman said, the husband said, well, I was walking in my car and about a couple of five guys came and carjacked me. I felt like they took my manhood. They you know, I felt very helpless. And then so they decided to buy guns, and they bought these really ridiculous guns. And then these holsters were like, man, just get rid of that holster, this Uncle Mike's holster, you know.
Is this the guy with the pink polo and the M16A2? Or
no,
hey,
no.
I like those guys.
But but that right there, it's what caused them to go ahead and have a mindset shift. Like, man, I cannot depend on the government. All these years I've been lied to, and I have to take security into my own hands.
Yeah, we should have that mindset shift before that happens. You know,
exactly.
What I mean?
Yeah. Well, it's
sometimes that's what it takes.
Exactly. Sometimes you can tell until you're blue in the face, but they need to actually, you know, something like that needs to happen to be like, holy crap, now I understand why these gun crazy people like have guns, because, you know, you have to be able to take responsibility over your own security.
Well, guys, let's start wrapping it up, man. Anybody got their closing thoughts? You want to talk a little bit more about Green Ops or throw it at the end?
Yeah. So Green Ops 2024 calendar is already out, and came out here to help out Matt and hopefully create a big community the way we have in Northern Virginia. So I appreciate all the students that came out from Texas, all around Texas. We had one guy that showed up from California. They came out of course. He's his second time. And thank everybody for supporting us. And 2024 Countdown is out.
So I want to say thank you to Sons of Liberty for supporting us as a brand and supporting me specifically, because you guys have been more than accommodating. Obviously, you know, you didn't have to do any of that. You know, I worked here, but when I left, things, you know, you could have been like, hey, all right, you know, sayonara, have fun. But every time I've come in, it's been like, hey, how are you doing? What can we do to help? You know, and that right there, I mean, no matter what anybody else says about any other situation and community and anything else, that's what matters if we're taking care of each other. And I want to say thank you to you guys for that and having us on today. As far as Green Ops Texas, you can find us on green-ops.com. You can find me, McGuire_TheWayForward on Instagram. If you guys have questions, you can email info@green-ops.com to get classes. The 2024 schedule for Green Ops Texas is pending right now. I'm waiting for approval from some ranges to deconflict scheduling, but it will be out directly. And please come out and train, whether it's with us, whether it's some other institution. Get out and get training. Buy a quality rifle or a quality pistol. Get your equipment set up and figure out. Get
Liberty. Also, my Instagram handle is ChrisAlvers580. Everything that I post is either competition shooting, training, physical fitness, that lifestyle, that preparedness, and you know, Second Amendment lifestyle.
And no shirts.
No shirts.
Well, guys, listen, so... again, if you have not heard of Green Ops, I highly, highly suggest you look into them. We don't hand out endorsements very often. You know, we have to really believe in something if we're gonna, you know, if we're gonna, you know, suggest to our followers, who I consider family, to go check it out. Like, Green Ops is something I truly believe in. The instruction is amazing. The culture is amazing. The people are solid. Definitely go check them out. And Kyle, take us out, man.
Yeah, man. We'll post up on the screen for post-production all the y'all's email addresses and handles and everything. I definitely suggest y'all follow them, even their personal Instagrams. You always have a lot of really good information. And like I said, I've been through the class. I took my neighbor through the basic carbine class, and he went from not being able to stick a mag in the right way to red dot shots at 400 yards. So he it was a massive shift. I mean, he had never really shot an AR until he bought one from me, and he's, you know, just 2 days of training, really world of difference. So definitely get out there and take some Green Ops classes. Take any classes. Just get out there and get training and be prepared. So thank you, everyone.
Thanks, guys.
Later, guys.
Thanks for joining us today right here at the Liberty Tree Studio. But be sure to visit us at solgw.com for hard-use blasters, badass swag, and much, much more.